welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. We debuted a new episode series in the fall of 2021 called Genre 101 Deep Dives. Kimberly McCreet, author of Friends Like These, joined me to talk about the mystery thriller genre. And today we have our second Genre 101 Deep Dive, featuring Mary Laura Philpott, answering your questions about memoirs and essays. Mary Laura first joined me on the show way back in spring of 2019 when she published her debut collection, I Miss You When I Blink, which was one of my best books of 2019. Her sophomore collection, Bomb Shelter, Love, Time, and Other Explosives, came out on April 12th. I absolutely adored this one too, and I shared my detailed thoughts about it on the spring book preview. Mary Laura's writing has been featured frequently by the New York Times and also appears in the Washington Post, The Atlantic, and other publications. Across her work, Mary Laura examines the overlap of the absurd and the profound in life, literature, and culture. Additionally, she is a former bookseller and worked at Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee, and she still lives in Nashville with her family. Welcome back, Mary Laura.
Hey, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited to get all the behind-the-scenes juice about memoirs and essays and talk about what is going to be one of my best books of 2022 so far.
I can't wait. This is one of my favorite things to talk about. You're going to have to cut me off. I love it.
All right. Good to hear. So today we are going to start out by touching a little bit on Bomb Shelter, Mary Laura's new book, and then we're going to dive into the memoir and essay questions, and we will be answering a lot of questions that you submitted. So for those who haven't read it yet, can you tell us a little bit about Bomb Shelter without giving away any major spoilers?
So Bomb Shelter is a memoir, kind of a slice of life memoir about a 2-year period in my life. And it was a period in my life when I was having to adjust to the idea of letting go of a lot of things. My children were getting older and I could see on the horizon this time when they were going to leave the nest. My parents were getting older and that was a whole slew of issues. I myself was getting older. My body was aging. I was kind of hitting that middle age, like, wait, is this really who I am? Is this what I look like? And also, I was just living in the world that we all live in right now, where it feels like things are kind of spinning out of control and falling apart, and all these surprises are just falling into our lap all the time. And so the two parts of my personality that are kind of always in a little bit of a tug of war, my optimism and my anxiety, were both in just high overdrive during this time period. But then something happened, and this is the thing that kind of kicks off Bomb Shelter and gets the clock ticking at kind of a whole new volume. I woke up one morning, my husband and I woke up to a horrible sound. We thought someone was ramming down our front door. And it turned out to be the sound of my teenage son's body hitting the bathroom floor. He was having a seizure. So he had walked into the bathroom, fell unconscious to the tile floor. His body was hitting the floor again and again. And from there, I kind of tell the story of taking him to the hospital, finding out what was going on. And then really kind of over the next 2 years, in addition to all that other stuff I was already thinking about, trying to get used to the idea that in the best case scenario, if he graduated from high school and went off to college, he would be going out into the world with this health situation. And I couldn't go with him and take care of him. So it's a lot about kind of holding it together while trying to let go. That's what it is.
That's absolutely terrifying. And I was riveted by that first essay. But I also loved how I felt like you sort of alternated the really intense essays about your son with the more slice of life essays. So as a reader, it was a little bit of the pendulum swinging back and forth and a mental break. And then we go back to intensity and then a mental break and we go back to intensity. And I really loved that.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, that's how life goes. You know, like the big stuff happens at the same time the little stuff is happening and one doesn't pause for the other. And you know, we're always kind of running on multiple tracks at the same time. And I was so aware of that during that time period too.
And I also have to tell you, did you watch the show Friday Night Lights?
Yes.
Okay. Your collection reminded me of the pilot of Friday Night Lights because they were flashing back to like Jason Street on the operating table and then back to the football game and then back to Lila crying in the hallway at the hospital. It gave me the same feeling.
Oh my God, I just got goosebumps. It's been so long since I've watched that show. But as you were describing it, I was like, I remember that. Oh, wow.
That's my all-time favorite TV show. So that's a high compliment.
You may be the only person who compares Bomb Shelter to Friday Night Lights, but I love it. And I will accept that gratefully. Thank you.
Okay, good. Very specific comparison.
Yeah.
All right. So can you tell us a little bit about what your inspiration was for this collection and why you decided to write it?
Yeah. In the beginning of the time period, right before I started writing this book. So I Miss You When I Blink came out in 2019. And at the end of that book tour, I remember, you know, texting with other writer friends going, how do you come up with the next book? Like, I have nothing. I don't know what I want to write. I was telling myself I did not want to write I Miss You When I Blink Part 2. Like, I didn't want to do another personal nonfiction narrative. I wanted to do something different. And I just sat there like bending myself into a pretzel mentally trying to come up with what is the different thing I'm going to write. And while I was doing that, you know, our brains do what they want to do. The brain wants what the brain wants. This book, Bomb Shelter, was honestly kind of starting to write itself in my head. Like, I would lie down to go to sleep at night and my brain would be like, you know, this story about this happening is kind of like that thing that happened when you were little and you could tell that story and then you could weave these together. It honestly sort of demanded to be written. Like, it came into my head and it was like, this is the thing you're going to do right now.
I feel like that's the sign that it's the right thing too.
I mean, whether or not it was the right thing, it was the only thing. Like, I couldn't, there was no way I was going to write anything else until I wrote this. So it just kind of took over. It took my brain hostage and it took my brain hostage for 2 years. And there it was.
Did you feel a lot of pressure? Because I Miss You When I Blink was so successful. Did you feel that pressure as you were trying to come up with your second idea?
Pressure only in that there was no longer this question of like, can I write a book? Like, I knew I could because I just had. So it was like, well, now I know this can be done. So there's no excuse. There's no like, I'm just not a writer. I don't know how to write books. Yes, I do. If anything, the pressure was coming from, the call is coming from within the house. The pressure was coming from within my own head because it was like, okay, I've done this once. I've gone through the whole life cycle of coming up with an idea, writing a book, publishing a book. I've done it. There's no reason I can't do it again. Come on. It was less that I felt like people were demanding it from me or that because the first book had done relatively well, there was somebody beating down my door to be like, now we have to have another one. But I do remember thinking this complete nonsense thought that it was so unfair that the first book couldn't just write the second one, that it couldn't be like, you know, grandchildren, like, all right, I wrote this book. Now this book will go write another one. Like, I had to start all the way over.
Moving kind of now into the more genre type questions. What was your thought process in deciding to publish Bomb Shelter as essays and then sort of deciding what to call it? And is it a memoir or is it essays or is it both?
What is it? This is a wonderful question. And it's one of those things where honestly, I am less interested in these labels because I tend to trust readers. I think readers will find a great book regardless of what category is stamped on it and follow the story. But I know there are marketing departments who need to categorize these things. And the way I think of essays and memoir in terms of books is on a spectrum. So on one end, you have essay collections that are just that, collections of essays. They're not linked by much other than voice and perhaps a bit in terms of theme. And then at the far other end of the spectrum, you have memoirs, book-length stories from a person's life, perhaps divided into chapters, but seen much more as a whole. And then in the middle, this wide middle area, you have what are often called memoirs and essays. And both of my books have been called memoirs and essays. But I would say my last book, I Miss You When I Blink, is classified as an essay collection because that's more what it is. It's further toward that end of the middle. Those essays are somewhat linked, thematically speaking. It wouldn't be a stretch at all to call it a memoir and essays, but it's definitely essays. Bomb Shelter, on the other hand, to me, is still in that middle space, but far closer to the memoir end of the spectrum. Again, you can absolutely describe it as a memoir and essays, but I feel like it sits on a different part of the spectrum, closer to the memoir end, because although it is absolutely built out of essays, that's how I write chapters that are essay-like, there's a much more obvious narrative arc pulling you through this book. It's a book-length story, although it also has smaller stories within it, as books often do.
I felt like there was absolutely a thread pulling you through. And like I was talking about that pendulum, you'd kind of do one chapter about your son, and then we'd kind of go back a little bit to childhood or sort of a life story, and then we're back to the narrative about your son again. I absolutely think that there was kind of more of a through line with this one.
Yeah. And if you look at the, you know, deep down into the various codes that are put on a book, I don't even know where this happens, but I know there are these little codes that go on it to kind of tell like a library where to shelve it or whatever. I Miss You When I Blank is coded as an essay collection, and Bomb Shelter is coded as a memoir.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Under Edelweiss, it's under personal memoir.
But you can tell by reading one and then reading the other, they're not that far apart on the spectrum. And it's subjective kind of making that call.
And to your knowledge, do publishers ever tell an author, if they, let's say an author comes in with an essay collection or an author comes in with a memoir, does a publisher ever suggest, hey, you should do this the other way? Like you should do this memoir as an essay collection, or you should do this essay collection as a memoir?
I'm sure that those conversations happen on a one at a time basis. And I think it probably depends a lot on the book. As for whether my publisher had ever, you know, ever counseled me to do one over the other. No, not really. There, we did have a lot of talks about things like what code do we put on it? What do we call it? I remember with I Miss You When I Blink, when we talked about whether it would have a subtitle, some sort of clarifying phrase that explains it. We ended up not doing a clarifying subtitle like Bomb Shelter has. You know, Bomb Shelter is Bomb Shelter, Love, Time, and Other Explosives. We didn't do a Love, Time, and Other Explosives type subtitle for I Miss You When I Blink, because I Miss You When I Blink was already such a long, unwieldy phrase that we were like, this is going to take up the whole cover. We just put essays on it. With Bomb Shelter, actually, this is, I'm now veering off into cover design, but in the initial cover for Bomb Shelter had the subtitle at the very top. So it said Love, Time, and Other Explosives, and then Bomb Shelter. And then in little script underneath that, it said a memoir in essays. But the earliest reviewers and bloggers were getting confused and thought a memoir in essays was the subtitle. So people were writing about it and saying Bomb Shelter, a memoir in essays. And so we changed it around. We took a memoir in essays off because, as I argued to my publisher, it just doesn't matter that much what the category is. What matters is what is this story? That's what people want to know. They want to know what kind of story am I getting here? So we took the subtitle, Love, Time, and Other Explosives, and moved it to the middle right under the title.
So that's interesting that publishers actually do sort of take feedback from early readers and make changes.
I don't know how often that happens, but in this case, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the planning of an essay collection. I would imagine it's very different than the planning of a novel or even a straight memoir. And I think this would maybe apply for you a little bit more to I Miss You When I Blink. But do you plan the entire collection around a particular theme and then go and write the essays? Or do you kind of write an essay and then sort of build out from there? Or do you just write a bunch of essays for various things and are like, how can I think about an overarching theme for this group of essays I've already written?
That's a great question. And I'm sure that it varies by writer and that it varies by book. But I can kind of compare and contrast with my last book, I Miss You When I Blink. I already had a stack of finished essays when I started trying to envision a book. It was actually that stack of essays that made me go, well, look at there. I've got a bunch of essays. But should I try to make a book? So at that point, it was a matter of looking at what I had already written, and what those essays had in common thematically. Realizing, oh, hey, I'm actually, through various different stories I'm telling, kind of going back to some of the same questions again and again, and then going, okay, what other stories could I tell along those themes? And how might I put them in order so that there is some emotional journey happening from one to the next and from beginning to end? I played around a lot with the order of those essays. I actually printed them out and laid them all over the floor and moved them around in a big rainbow.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, I'm a big believer that structure is story. Putting things in a different order, it doesn't just change the chronology. It changes what story you're telling. So
100%.
Yeah. So that was I Miss You When I Blink. With Bomb Shelter, I knew what story I was telling. I knew where it would begin. I knew how I wanted to land it. and I had a good idea of the plot, or the emotional plot is what I call it, this journey that the me character was going on. And I knew which pieces of my life I wanted to pull and share and what stories I wanted to tell. So it was really more a matter of writing them and then making sure I had them in the right order that supported the story I was telling, which took some work, but not as much trial and error with I Miss You When I Blink, because here there was much more of an overall plot driving things.
As we heard about you thinking about as you were going to sleep at night.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And what do the discussions with your publisher and your editor look like as far as the theme of a collection? So do they have a say, or do they come in over the top and are like, oh no, let's market it under this theme, whereas you had come in with something else? How does that kind of all look?
It's, again, probably different for different books and for different writers and for different publishers. But the way I look at that question is that something has maybe gone a little wrong if you're having the what theme is this book as a marketing conversation. Like deciding the theme of a book really should not be a marketing decision. I understand what you're asking, though. Like, especially if you're at the far end of the spectrum where it's truly more of a collection of assorted writings, you do have to figure out how to describe that collection on the inner flap of a book, right?
Absolutely.
I would argue, though, that if you're thinking of that as a marketing question, maybe it's not quite time to seek out publication for that collection.
Well, and I've read a book of, they were nonfiction. Yes. So essays where I felt like this came over the top from marketing as far as the theme of how to string these together, because the theme and the string felt very tenuous to me. Like I could just feel that as a reader.
Yeah. And I feel like when that happens,
not your books, by the way.
Thank you. I feel like when that happens, perhaps there was along the way, someone kind of jumped the gun in terms of saying this should be a book. Maybe there needed to be some more time on maybe another draft or two on the writer's part where they are figuring out what they're writing toward, like where they can come to their publisher and go, okay, I've written 25 short pieces. And although they seem to be about a lot of different things, here's what holds them together. Here's the glue. I feel like if the writer knows that going in, you're going to have much more productive and shorter and fewer marketing type conversations.
And you'll feel it in the writing, I feel like, too, as a reader.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe you do start with just a stack of stuff. Like, here's a bunch of stuff I've written. But if you're going to pull it together into a book, you do need to, at some point, have been writing with that thematic territory in mind. And sometimes that means you go back over your work as you write and as you edit, weaving certain thematic threads in more strongly.
That makes sense. Switching gears a little bit, how does it feel knowing so much of your personal life is going to end up in your writing? So kind of how I'm thinking about this, and I've seen Instagram influencers talk about this phenomenon. When so much of your personal life ends up in your content, do you ever feel like you are trying to balance living life for living life versus living life or making certain decisions because you think they're going to end up in a good story that will make for good content or something good to put in the book?
I see what you're saying. First of all, I'm so glad I'm not an Instagram influencer.
Oh, me too. I mean, I guess some people would say that I kind of am for books, but like my personal life has no part of it.
But in, yeah, right. But in a book way, it's this wonderful, different, nerdy thing and it's great.
Right.
Yeah, no, I could never, that looks so hard. And I think that would be stressful. But yeah, this is a great question. And actually very little of my personal life is in my books.
See, you're good because I feel like I know lots about your personal life from reading your books.
Which means I've done my job well.
Exactly.
But if you count right, and I think the last time I looked, and I didn't aim for this, but it just happened. Both of my books have either the exact same number of chapters or different by just one. Like I think one has 32 essays and the other one has 31 or 32, which if you think about it, that means I have told you a total of 64 stories from my life.
Right.
But anybody's life is way more than 64 stories, right? So I have picked out some stories from my life to write as essays or chapters for these books because they help me tell whatever bigger story I'm telling. But I'm not just journaling my whole life out here. Like most of my life happens off the page. But like you just said, because most readers only know the parts they see on the page, it's a very easy assumption to go, well, okay, there it is. This must be her whole life. And I do that too. As a reader, as readers, we naturally string things together and we fill in the blanks and we kind of assume that this way we have filled in the blanks with what we've been given on the page equals a whole. But there's a difference between the me character in these books and me, the actual person in my actual life. They're not 100% the same. My life as a person is much wider and more varied and full of stuff that's not on these pages. But to your question about life as content, I was thinking about our family went through a stressful thing a few months ago. And at the time, I had a couple of people say things to me like, well, I guess you've got some good material for your next book. You know, and at the time I thought, you know, on one hand, I thought, like, oh my God, how could you say that? My life is not a content generator for books. But simultaneously, I mean, I did think maybe I'll write about this at some point. I might, but only if it serves a larger story I'm telling. I don't feel any sort of compulsion to like share.
Share just to share.
Yeah, I don't actually love the word share being used in writing because I don't write books just, I'm not writing books to share. I'm trying to write a story here. You know, I'm not out there sharing what I do just because I like to share. I feel like documenting my life. I'm so glad I am not a reality show or or an influencer.
Oh, yes. Woo.
And not to, you know, I don't mean to insult people who work as influencers. I know that is a hard job. They also have to be very careful about where the line is between their real life and the pieces of their lives that they put out there.
Sure, absolutely. And kind of still on the topic of personal life ending up on the page in some capacity, how do you typically approach telling your own personal stories, but they're also other people's stories too, because they're players in these stories?
Yeah, I love that question. It's a great question. I remember years ago, I interviewed David Sedaris and I asked him that same question. I was like, how do you, like, where's the line?
Does he have a line?
Yeah, he does.
Oh, he does. Okay. Because I feel like he's so out there and candid with his stories.
He's very careful about involving anyone else in his stories. And I remember specifically, this is such a weird thing to remember, but I remember he says he doesn't write about sex ever.
Oh, interesting. It's I've read his stuff and I'm trying to like, I guess you're, yeah.
There's no sex in there.
I've never noticed that there's no sex though. It's never like jumped out at me.
Well, good job, David Sedaris. He didn't leave you feeling like there was a gap.
Right.
This is actually one of my favorite things to talk about because I am super cautious and respectful of boundaries. Because here's the thing, like sometimes in order to use a piece of my own life experience to tell a story, I may need to use a part of that story that overlaps with someone else's life experience. So the first question I always ask is, do I have to use this experience at all to tell my bigger story? Or could I leave it out? And if the answer is, well, yes, I have to tell this part of my life experience to tell this larger story and make sense, then I ask, okay, is there a way to tell it but leave out the other person's part, to omit that overlap for the sake of privacy and boundaries? Most of the time, those two questions help me find my way to telling a story in a way that doesn't involve anyone else. In the rare instances where it's clear that, I'm going to have to tell a piece of someone else's story in order to do what I'm doing, then it's more of a one-off situation each time. So for example, in Bomb Shelter, Bomb Shelter is a story about a woman, me, who is both an optimist and a very anxious person at the same time. And that duality is put to the test as she reaches the age where it's time to start letting people go in her life. And you notice I'm talking about myself in third person because I'm trying to see this story as like a story about a character.
Right.
And as I mentioned earlier, what kind of sets this whole ticking clock into a louder gear is something big and important that happens, which is that suddenly there is a new threat to all she holds dear. Her son becomes ill. And now she has to get comfortable with the idea of letting him go off into the world where he is in danger and vulnerable, like all of us little vulnerable human beings are. So that woman is me, and that son is my son. And I can't tell my story without including the part where I become obsessively worried about my son. And I can't explain why I'm obsessively worried without including a scene showing why. So I'm going to have to figure out how to tell the story of finding him unconscious on the floor, the story of that awful morning and how it made me feel as a mother. In this case, he is old enough, he's actually an adult now, to give meaningful consent. So I felt like I could ask him and I could show him what I'd written and we could work together to kind of determine what he was comfortable with my including. But what made it really even more high stakes for me is that he doesn't remember that morning.
Oh.
It doesn't exist in his memory. It exists very clearly in my memory as if I have it.
So you're putting a memory in his head almost.
Right.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. It's very clear in my memory, but not in his. So he had to trust me to tell something that he couldn't have told himself. And while the perspective in that scene stays really entirely with me, it's never like, my son felt this or my son wondered that. It's always what I'm seeing, what I'm thinking. I had to work really hard to do right by that story because it's not something he could have told. But, you know, I construct other sort of walls and boundaries. Like, you'll notice I don't use my children's names at all, you know, when I do write pieces of my story that include them. I don't need to give you a full picture of their lives to give you a picture of my character's life as a mother. And the rule of thumb that I use when I'm working on a scene and I'm trying to make sure that I'm really being respectful of those boundaries is the once upon a time rule. So if I can look at a scene and say, I can describe this clearly as once upon a time, there was a woman who blah, 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 then I'm good. If it is veered into once upon a time, there was a boy who blah, 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 or somebody else who blah, 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 then I've wandered into telling someone else's story and I need to start over and try to keep that perspective, you know, squarely anchored in my own eyeballs.
Interesting. This is a lot to navigate, I feel like.
It is.
And I feel like even novelists probably navigate this to some extent too, not as directly as someone writing nonfiction.
Yeah.
And moving kind of into the memory topic, I got to say, I can't take credit for this question. This was submitted by one of my lovely patrons, but I love this question. How do you handle memory in your writing? Like your personal memory of events happening versus other people that were there's memories of events. We know that everyone's memory probably is not the same. Do you sort of, as you're writing, do interview people that were a part of certain experiences? And how does that get put into your writing?
That is a really good question. Good job, reader, whoever submitted that question. And obviously, like, that's harder for things that happened further in the past. Different memories store themselves differently in our brains. But when I think about how do I make sure that I'm remembering something correctly? Well, first of all, I tend to only write about things I actually do remember because the things that I'm sort of obsessed by or interested in or want to revisit are the things I think about a lot. And I think about them because they're in there. So that's kind of like, that's the first hurdle to clear. Like, I'm not going to write about something I don't remember at all because I'm probably not that interested in it. If I were, I would have remembered it. I interview people. I can look back. The great thing about this day and age, maybe it's great, maybe it's not, but I can look back at text messages and emails. I have all the text messages from the morning we found our son on the floor because my phone never deleted them. So, you know, I have text messages to like my sister-in-law, who's a pediatric neurologist, from the ambulance asking her what is going on. I have text messages to the, you know, the teacher at my daughter's school saying, please look out for her today. Her brother's in the hospital. So that helps. But for, you know, for things that happen in childhood, I don't have that kind of thing. I don't have verbatim records of what was said. But again, if I'm writing about it, it's probably because it burned itself into my memory for some reason. So I've got a pretty good account in there. But there's, I don't know, there's actually a chapter in Bomb Shelter, it's about 2/3 of the way through, where I rattle off rapid fire a bunch of these little micro stories that I remember from childhood. And I say right up front, I'm probably getting the details wrong. And I know these stories have holes in them, but I'm rattling them off as a way of noticing and pointing out what my brain chose to store. And they are all these catastrophic stories, some of them almost comically catastrophic. Like, there's one about the time my mother's grandmother cooked my mom's pet duck and served it to the family for Easter dinner.
Oh my gosh.
And the point of that whole chapter was, here are a handful of things my brain chose to recall. Why? Why did I choose to remember all these catastrophic stories? In a way, the remembering is part of the story.
That's such a good point.
And I'm not trying to say it doesn't matter whether you get things right. What matters is what you remember. Both things matter.
Absolutely. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but that completely makes sense.
Brains are weird.
They are weird. All right. On a totally different note.
Yeah.
And I guess a little bit having to do with memory, but do publishers attempt to fact check memoirs and or essay collections in any way, shape, or form? And I've asked one other podcast guest this, a woman who wrote a memoir that with the story in the memoir was bonkers.
Yeah.
And I was like, when you're pitching this to a publisher, do they ask you to prove any of it? And she said, yeah, they requested police documents.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And I figure that probably depending on what sort of territory you write about, it probably depends a little bit on that. I did have a legal review of both my books to make sure I hadn't crossed any lines in terms of writing about other people in a way that would get us in trouble. In my first book, I had to change a tattoo that I mentioned to make sure that it was not like an identifying thing.
Uh-huh. You're identifying somebody.
Right, which is actually probably a great idea. I should have done that myself. But that was pretty clear and easy. Again, I think there's a spectrum here. Like, some memoirs probably have a lot of historic facts and prominent figures and things, like you said, police records that need to be cross-checked against history books and records. Not so much here.
Sure.
I will say I did get to go through a very detailed fact-checking process with part of this book. The chapter that is in the book called Bomb Shelter, which obviously gives the book its title. Yeah, it was adapted as a standalone piece for The Atlantic recently. And at The Atlantic, as at similar places, that fact checker was very detailed.
This is about your dad's involvement with Raven Rock.
Yes, yes, the secret underground nuclear bunker.
Right. And that is a book written by Garrett Graff, the author of The Only Plane in the Sky.
Yep.
He's been on the podcast.
Love him. Well, Garrett Graff changed my life because it was my dad calling to say, hey, can you order me this new book by Garrett Graff, that created the conversation into which my dad just casually dropped, oh yeah, it reminds me of when I worked at Raven Rock, which he had never mentioned in my life. So The Atlantic had me adapt that chapter as a standalone piece, which they just published, which meant I took the chapter and then I pulled in some other pieces from the book to give it context. And I wrote kind of a fresh introduction and a little bit of concluding stuff that would make it standalone and make sense without the rest of the book. But I had to work with their fact checker, who's very, very detailed. And she got out Garrett's book, Raven Rock, and was fact checking. She called my dad and had my dad verify all these things that I said.
Interesting.
Which, as I told my publisher when I wrote the book, I was like, I have emails that can back all this stuff. I have emails from my dad where after we had this phone conversation, I was like, hold on, you got to write this down. But the fact checker had to hear it from his own lips. But she also, this is so funny, she also tweaked things. Like, when I wrote that chapter for the book, obviously the book is coming out now. I turned it in a year ago. I was writing it a year before that. So that was 2 years ago. I wrote a sentence that said something like, I'm almost 20 years older now than my dad was when blah, blah, blah. This fact checker was like, I'm looking at the numbers and I think you are exactly 20 years older. I'm like, well, now I am. So for The Atlantic, we had to update that.
That's detailed.
Yeah, she was really detailed. So that was very different from anything I have gone through with my publisher. But I would say with publishers, it probably depends a lot on what's in your memoir. And then I think there are things, and I can't speak to this specifically, my agent could probably tell you, within my contract that say, I verify that all this stuff is true. And if I were to get busted later for making all this up, it would be on me. All the trouble would be on me, not on my publisher.
to prevent a James Fry situation. Yeah.
James Fry. Yes. Nobody wants that again.
Nope. Nope. PTSD from that. All right. Let's get into your book recommendations.
Okay.
As usual, Mary Laura is going to share 2 old books she loved, 2 new books she loved, a reading trend she does not love, and an upcoming release she is looking forward to. Mary Laura, tell us about the first old book you loved.
Okay. Neither of these are very old.
They're old enough.
But they're, they're not brand new. So, but one of them is about ye olden times, and that is Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, which I put off reading. I didn't read it when it first came out because it seemed like it was going to be everything I don't like in a book. I am not a big, I'm just not a big historical fiction person. I'm sorry. I thought it was going to give me flashbacks to studying Shakespeare in school, which was not my favorite. I'm sorry again. But when I finally read it, I loved it. And I should have known I would, because everything Maggie O'Farrell writes is gold. And somehow she made this story about Shakespeare's son from hundreds and hundreds of years ago seem immediate and relevant. And I just had to keep reading to find out what happened, even though I knew what happened. Part of why I loved it might have been that thematically it had so much in common with what was on my mind when I was writing Bomb Shelter, but I folded down so many pages of that book. If anyone out there has been putting it off for the same reasons I did, please give it a chance. It's awesome.
I know so many people who said exactly what you said. They did put it off and then they ended up loving it.
Yes. I love to be proven wrong. Oh, it is such a good feeling to be I thought it would, pleasant surprise is my favorite feeling.
It's like books you should never read the back flap of before you pick up.
Totally. Someone should have just handed me that book on printed out on paper. No cover.
I still haven't gotten up the guts to pick it up. And I'm turned off for the same reason you were initially, even though I've loved Maggie O'Farrell's other books.
Sarah, it's so good.
I know. I just have to find the right time to pick it up.
Yeah, maybe not right now, but at some point.
No.
And do it with a pencil in your hand, because just on a sentence level, it is so good.
And I've also heard it's divisive. I mean, I actually, when you said you wanted to share this, was so surprised when I checked my spreadsheet that we had not already talked about it on the big show.
Oh, wow.
Because I felt like we had.
Yeah.
We had talked about it on some bonus episodes for patrons, and my two co-hosts, they both shared it on separate bonus episodes, and they had very opposite opinions about it.
Interesting.
That is Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell. And tell us about the second old book you loved.
So my second old, but not that old book, since my first one was fiction, I'll do nonfiction for this one. Lacey Crawford's book, Notes on a Silencing. It is a memoir, firmly on the memoir end of the spectrum. It is fantastic. It is about an event that came to, in a way, define her life in a certain way. It's an assault that happened when she was in boarding school. And she does this utterly amazing job of telling that story with such beautiful writing and this wonderful balance of restraint and truly visceral emotional connection. And it just, I wrote her like a fan email after I read it, to say it just succeeds on so many levels, the literary level, emotionally, structure. It is a wonderful example of how a memoir can be a true story about a piece of someone's life, multiple pieces of someone's life, but not a whole biography of their entire existence. Lacey Crawford could very well write a different memoir one day about a different set of events in a different time period. You know, people can be serial memoirists. So I kind of hope she'll write another one someday. She also writes fiction, but if I were teaching a class on how to write memoir, this book would 100% be on our syllabus.
I have never heard of it, and I'm shocked.
Oh my God, it's so, I'm jealous of you that you have it ahead of you.
I'm going to listen to it on audio. This sounds, I've read that the boarding school where the assault happened, St. Paul's, this book spurred them to come out with a public apology to her, which is great. And then I actually also just finished a book called Tell Me Everything by Erica Krauss.
Oh yeah.
Which sounds very sort of complimentary to this book. And it's about sexual assaults having to do at a college with their football program.
Interesting.
But school cover-ups, all that kind of stuff sounded very similar.
Well, Lacey Crawford is roughly my same age, maybe exactly my same age. And the school she went to was a nearby kind of rival school, same world as the boarding school my husband went to. And I made him read it. As soon as I finished it, I was like, oh my God, you've got to read this. And he kept putting the book down in his lap and looking at me and going, she gets all of this so right. Like she has just, he's like, I feel like I've gone back in time. She captures what that world was like. So, it's beautiful on a sentence level. The whole thing is good. She does this amazing job, kind of like you talked about earlier with the Friday Night Lights reference, of being in the moment, but then in the present, and then pulling in just the right threads from other times in her life to weave them together and show the echoes of how one thing can change so much. It's a masterpiece.
I cannot wait to listen to it. I wonder if this didn't get as much attention right when it came out because it was July 2020 and like who wanted to read about sexual assault at that point?
Oh, July 2020.
I know. I mean,
I remember that first pandemic year, my reading life was all topsy-turvy and the stuff that I thought I liked reading wasn't holding my attention. And this was one of the books that broke through my scattered brain and really held my attention.
Very intense personal memoirs were what worked for me then. I mean, I always loved those, but
you are going to love this book.
I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you for putting it on my radar.
Yeah. And then follow her on Twitter because this whole topic and world is something she cares a lot about it and she stays involved and is an advocate for.
I'm not going to follow her until after I read the books. I don't want to spoil anything.
Oh, good. Good point.
That was Notes on a Silencing by Lacey Crawford. And tell us about the first new book you love. And this is actually not out yet. It's coming out in 6 days.
Yes, there's two books coming out, one right after the other this spring. And I think of them as related. Because first of all, I'm friends with both the authors and they are friends with each other And the books are similar in a way because they're both about families. And we have a joke in my house. My kids would always see me, like when they were little, they would see me reading a book and they would go, "What's your book about, Mom?" And I would say, "A family." And they would go, "But what's the family doing?" And I'm like, it's just a book about what a family is.
It's a family drama. It's every book I read.
Yeah. So now they'll see me reading and they're like, "Is that a book about a family?" Yes, it is. So I have two very different vibes, but both about a family. One is Let's Not Do That Again by Grant Ginder. And it is a hoot. It is so funny. And while I was reading it, I kept thinking, it feels so good to have fun again. And I heard somebody, I should give credit, but I don't know who said this. Someone on Instagram, and then Grant like reposted it, said, this book is like a mashup of the show, the HBO show Veep, the political satire.
Uh-huh.
And have you seen the show called The Other Two?
No.
About these two adult siblings. It's like a mashup of those two things, but it's also its own wonderful thing. It's about a family where the father has passed away. The mother is a congresswoman. There's an adult son, an adult daughter. Everyone has their own agenda and baggage and love life, and everyone's lives come kind of crashing together. It is just a delight. Great to read by the pool, I would say. Okay, so that's my one family book. My other family book, very different vibe, is called Marrying the Ketchups. And I am such a doofus that I thought this was going to be about a family called the Ketchups and that there would be a wedding.
Have you never worked in a restaurant?
No.
Okay, so if you've worked in a restaurant, you will immediately know what marrying the ketchups means.
Right. I did not know that at the end of the night, you go and pour all the ketchups into one bottle or whatever, and that's called marrying the ketchups. I kept going like, come on, these people are named the Sullivans. When are we going to meet the ketchups? But this big extended family, the Sullivans in Chicago, they have a family restaurant called Sullivans that kind of works like a big magnet to pull all the family members back in. So you meet the adult cousins, you meet the grandparents. Everyone has had some sort of personal shakeup in their lives that has brought them back home and back into the orbit of each other and the restaurant. And it's warm and it's real, and she doesn't force any sort of big plot twisty stuff or unfair closure on everyone. Everything kind of happens the way real things happen. And to me, that's a comforting kind of read, just to read about other families who love each other, but are, you know, a mix of functional and dysfunctional. And I loved it. It also is funny in some ways and touching in some ways. And it's just such a classic example of what my kids would say my reading type is, just a book about a family.
Relatably dysfunctional, not like crazy town dysfunctional.
Right, right, right.
I'm really looking forward to this one. I'm going to be picking it up really soon. I loved her book, The Hopefuls. So I'm excited about this one too.
I did too. She's really good.
I do have to ask, since I've already researched this book in preparation for talking about it on the show.
Yeah.
And the publisher had, again, we're getting to labels, had labeled it in Edelweiss as literary fiction. But having read The Hopefuls, I'm sort of like, I feel like that's more contemporary, maybe a little bit lighter than literary. How did you feel it was on the literary scale?
I have such mixed feelings about that term, literary fiction.
We need a whole Genre 101 episode on literary.
We do. Like, again, it feels like a label that was contrived for reasons that have so little to do with story and the real reasons people read, and everything to do with some kind of marketing stuff that I don't understand.
Or maybe awards.
Right. I mean, I feel like readers follow the story. They will go where a good story is. And she has told a good story. When I do employ the term literary, I tend to use it to mean this story has really high integrity in terms of technical stuff. Like, you're not going to find sentences that don't actually work. You're not going to find misplaced modifiers. You're going to find really artfully structured chapters and callbacks. And there's been as much attention to the art form here as there was to the story. Sometimes there's not. Sometimes you read a book and you're like, you know, they really weren't paying all that much attention to the art form. They just wanted to get this story out there. It was entertaining. I loved it. Super. I'm a dork and I loved English class, and I love that kind of structural, artful sentence level, word level stuff. So to me, I enjoy when both things are there, when you get a story and it's just really, really polished in a literary sense. And I don't think one has to exclude the other. I would say Jennifer Close does write fiction that has good literary integrity. But I know some people use that term to mean, like some people say literary fiction is very serious and often historical and very deep. And they'll say a book that's funny can't be literary fiction, or a book that is warm and leaves you with a light feeling can't be literary fiction. And I think that's asinine. I just think it's a term that it has so many different meanings depending on who's using it and why.
Absolutely. Because I think of it a little bit differently than you do, I think.
Oh, well, how do you think of it?
For me, it's more of a feeling. It's like, is this a more serious book where the writing style is such that it takes a little bit more concentration? It might move a little slower, but it's beautifully done. And more sort of lighter stuff is like, oh yeah, I can read this by the beach with like chaos going on around me and I can still concentrate on it.
Interesting. So see, I think that term, it means so many different things. Labels, I tell you, they're not always useful.
They can be very problematic because I'm trying to describe a book to my listeners. It's hard to not put some sort of label on it.
Yeah. I would say if people are not familiar with Jennifer Close, and I feel like she should be so much more of a household name than she is, but if you're not familiar with her books, think of like Emma Straub. If you like Emma Straub's writing, you're going to like Jennifer Close's writing.
I think that's sort of a sweet spot.
Yeah. Me too.
That was Marrying the Ketchups by Jennifer Close, not about the ketchup family. All right, let's talk about the reading trend you are not really on board with these days.
Oh my gosh. I keep seeing people posting, and just stay off the internet. I keep seeing people posting like these challenges where they're going to go back and reread the classics. Like the other day I saw somebody post, I'm going to go back and reread all of Henry James. And I thought, I would rather run myself over with my own car. And no offense to Henry James. It's great. Classics are classics for a reason. I enjoyed them the first time.
So you did enjoy them the first time?
Yeah.
Okay.
I loved English class. Like Virginia Woolf, I enjoyed that once. I just have no desire there at all to go back and do it again. And I don't know what that means about me as a person or as an intellectual, but I have never been like, you know what I need to do? I need to get all my Shakespeare back out and read it. I need to go back and read Emily Dickinson again. I don't. I did it once. I am so happy that I absorbed it. Probably I missed a lot of things because I was young, and that's a real shame. But I don't want to. I'm not much of a rereader generally, actually. I don't reread much.
Me neither.
In terms of contemporary reading, there are very, very few books I actually revisit.
Well, there's so many books out there that you want to try in the limited time you have to read.
There's something about that first impression and what a book does the first time you meet it. And that changes when you go back to it. And sometimes it changes in a good way, but sometimes it overwrites that first experience. And if it was a great first experience, I want to keep it that way.
Absolutely.
So I'm not going to go reread Henry James. I'm sorry, I can't.
Well, two things. Number one, to make you less worried about your level of intellectualism, I did not like them the first time around and still don't want to try them again. My listeners know this about me. And second of all, do you remember the book you shared the last time you came on the show that you did not like? Dovetails real nicely into this category.
Oh, it does? What was it? What did I say?
Little Women.
Oh, I think I'm the only person. I'm so ashamed. Like, that is something you can really not say out loud. People will want to punch you.
Oh, I know. I don't think I've read it, although I'm not sure. This is how my young childhood reading went.
I did read it in school, but this is probably a case for rereading. Like, I probably should reread it because I would get different things out of it. But I was young, maybe I was too young. And I just remember being bored and being like, these people sitting by the fire, I don't care.
The next day too.
Right.
All right. Let's talk about your new release you're excited about.
Well, I just actually mentioned Emma Straub. We were talking about Jennifer Close, and she has a wonderful, wonderful new novel called This Time Tomorrow, coming out this spring, I believe in May.
May 17th, yes.
Yes, and it is female protagonist in New York City, who was a teenager. The time she goes back to is being a teenager in the 90s, which of course I was a teenager in the 90s, so that was relatable to me. She's bouncing back and forth between like her 40th birthday and being a teenager in the 90s. And for a lot of reasons, this book felt emotionally familiar to me. I would say thematically, there's a lot of overlap with Bomb Shelter.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, just in terms of being able to let things go and time moving and people getting older. And in this book, at the very beginning of the book, you meet the main character around her 40th birthday and her dad is in the hospital. And so she's worried about her dad. And so much of just grappling with, there's so much we don't have control over. You can't control things. You can't save everybody. And you know, we all have this little human instinct to think, well, if I just did something differently, I could change how everything turns out. Like everything is up to me. And of course it's not. So I love this book because it felt emotionally familiar to me. I also love time travel stuff. So I'm on board for any kind of remake of a time travel story. And it's entertaining. It's got that wonderful Emma Straub balance of funny and deep and a little bit of an edge to it. And it's just a joyful, wonderful book that I think is obviously going to take the world by storm.
Yeah, this book's going to do well, I think.
Yeah. She's a good storyteller.
That was This Time Tomorrow by Emma Straub. And I love to close out every episode with asking my guests the same question. And that is, what is the last 5-star book you read?
I would say probably, I don't measure them in stars, but if I'm thinking of like the last book where I was like, dang, that was good. I loved, and this book actually comes out the same day Bomb Shelter does, Delia Ephron has a new memoir called Left on 10th. And it is a joy. It is about, it's another kind of slice of life memoir. I guess you could call it a memoir and essays. I would call it a memoir about the period of her life between after her sister, Nora Ephron, has passed away. And Delia is living with her husband. He passes away. And then she meets this great new love of her life at the same time she is diagnosed with the same illness her sister had. And so she's just in this period of time where it's like the highs and the lows are so intense and the big stuff and the little stuff is all happening together. Again, it's another one where I felt like this feels emotionally familiar to me. Like maybe it's because we were thinking about a lot of the same stuff. I think it would be a fun book club experiment to read Bomb Shelter and Left on 10th together.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But I loved it. She's a great storyteller. She's a fun writer. She just has a way of telling a story where you put it down and you feel good.
Sure. I loved her novel, Syracusa.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved that book. So I do want to read this. I have to work on my timing and make sure I read it at the right time.
She writes in Left on 10th about the time when she was writing Syracuse.
Oh, great. I love the behind the scenes of when I was writing X book.
I do too.
That's Left on 10th by Delia Ephron. Mary Laura, this was so much fun. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it so much.
So y'all, the April Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Mary Laura's picks for categories like the biggest trend you've been seeing with memoirs and essays lately, and your biggest struggle or challenge with the memoir essay genre. If you'd like to get this bonus episode plus others, you can support the show on Patreon. There's a link in my show notes and in my Instagram bio. And in 2 weeks, which is May 4th, Dolan Perkins Valdez will be joining me. She is the author of Take My Hand, which is one of my favorite books of 2022 so far. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at sarahsshelves, on Instagram at sarahsbookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.